Morning glory and evening grace, America, and aloha. It's Hugh Hewitt broadcasting this week from AM 690, The Answer in Honolulu, and so pleased to be here. Today I'm joined for the entire program by my friend Richard Norton Smith, whose brand new book, On His Own Terms, A Life of Nelson Rockefeller, is absolutely essential reading. If you love anything about America, history and politics, but especially if you care about 2016 and the Republican Party for reasons which we're about to talk about, and I've linked it over to HughHewitt.com. If you want to call, 1-800-520-1234. If you want to send me a tweet question for Richard, at Hugh Hewitt, Richard remains resolutely not on Twitter. Am I correct, Mr. Smith?
God, I can't even spell it.
There you go. RichardNortonSmith.net, though, if you're interested in all things Richard. Richard, let me read you two headlines that will remarkably make you think of parts of your book, I believe.
Yeah.
Rand Paul on marijuana, I made mistakes. He gave an interview today in which he admits smoking dope.
Right.
Mark Levin to the GOP, I am 1 inch away from leaving you. Mark's a good friend of mine, extraordinarily gifted talk show host, and he is deeply angry. In both of those, I am reminded both of Rockefeller's strident anti-drug absolutism and of the Goldwater challenge to Rockefeller that is obviously still alive in Mark's anger.
Not only alive, I mean, literally, one of the remarkable things about this story, and I've written a lot of books over the years, and I can't think of a similar moment that is such a crossroads. But, you know, the book opens with that night, the second night of the Republican convention in the Cow Palace, July 14th, 1964. It's after midnight, and Rockefeller is standing in front of a convention that he manifestly does not own, ostensibly on behalf of a platform plank decrying extremism. Where have you heard that before?
Exactly.
He defines extremism, however, quite explicitly as the Ku Klux Klan, the American Communist Party, and the John Birch Society. Well, yes, the rest, as they say, is history. This was the first television convention. And although the planners knew that it was important for them to push that appearance as late as possible, they even underestimated the impact that it had. Of course, what it did was it tended, for millions of people who are not accustomed to seeing people behave like that, it tended to confirm Rockefeller's point about extremists. Now, but here's the thing. That's the night the Republican Party changed. I would argue nothing is forever, nothing is permanent, but it's never gone back. The next morning, it was a different party. It was Barry Goldwater's party. It was a Southern and Western party. It was a party poised for Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan and Newt Gingrich, and yes, the Tea Party. So here we are 50 years later, and I would argue that just as the Goldwater movement was always about more than Goldwater, I would say the libertarian branch of the conservative movement, of the Republican Party, is larger than Rand Paul. Although at this point, I think it has its primary vehicle as Rand Paul. And I would not be at all surprised in 2016 if the latter-day version of the Goldwater grassroots passionate movement were to take on the party establishment and enjoy as much success as it did 50 years ago.
Although I don't know that Senator Paul has a Cliff White, and we'll explain what that means.
Yeah.
And I also believe that the front page of the New York Times tonight is about ISIS, and yesterday was Australia, and Rockefeller was for 9% of the GDP going into the defense budget,
yeah,
right?
Oh,
and
yeah.
Isn't that remarkable?
The ultimate Cold Warrior.
Yeah, so there is this uber national security wing of the party,
yes,
which remains largely unrepresented in the lists right now. There isn't anyone, you know, Ted Cruz will speak about it a little bit. Marco Rubio is full-throated. Mitt Romney was very full-throated and warned about Putin. But there really isn't the internationalist yet, you know, wanting to run on internationalism the way that Rockefeller did.
But it's also interesting because Paul is tapping into more than just war weariness. I mean, there is this unusual confluence on the left and on the right. There are populists on both extremes, if I may use that term, and there are isolationists, or at the very least, that's such a loaded term. There are people who are profoundly reluctant to see history, recent history, repeat itself. How about that?
And there is also, this is a little inside baseball for the people who know, there is also a Henry Cabot Lodge in the wings waiting as he waited in 64 in the form of Ben Carson, I think, Richard Norton Smith. The unlikeliest person to destroy someone's ambitions can be the person who you never saw coming.
Yeah, of course. Remember, Lodge turned out to be a one primary wonder.
Exactly.
And of course, the great great story of the campaign was he was run almost as a joke. Remember?
By tell people the story. No one will believe this.
I mean, there's a great movie somewhere in the Lodge campaign of 64, which was cooked up out of thin air by some gangsters, really, who, from their own limited political experience, believed the biggest problem in any campaign was the candidate. If you could run a campaign without the candidate, you'd be in much better shape. So Henry Cabot Lodge was the non-candidate. He wasn't here. No one knew what his views were.
He was in Vietnam as the ambassador to the Republic of Vietnam.
Exactly. Yep. Lyndon Johnson's ambassador to Vietnam. And so, and of course, he came from Massachusetts, so lots of people in the first in the nation primary in New Hampshire thought of him as one of them.
And so when he actually upsets Rockefeller and basically derails his candidacy.
It was all downhill from there.
Rockefeller later co-opts the staffer who put together the joke campaign. He said, what would it have taken you not to do it? And the guy said, a bribe. And Rockefeller says, how much? And the kid says, 10 grand. And I quote now, it's a quote, so don't be offended. Christ, Rockefeller said, I spent 3 million. But we got to tell the three campaigns, Richard, too, for the benefit of the Steelers fans listening.
Sure.
1960, 1964, 1968. Rockefeller is in the mix every time. Let's go to 1960.
Well, 60, of course, it could be argued. In fact, I think I didn't do it in the book, but a strong case could be made. Nelson Rockefeller's greatest chance of being nominated by the Republican Party was before he took the oath of office as governor of New York. And remember, in 1958 was a disaster for the Republicans. It was a six-year election, and the Eisenhower administration was running out of gas, and they lost a bunch of seats everywhere. Two people emerged from 58 as national figures. One was Nelson Rockefeller, who had upset Abel Harriman to win the governorship of New York. During the race, one of Harriman's supporters at the New York Post suggested that Harriman should have the campaign slogan, "Don't swap multimillionaires in the middle of the stream," because they both were multimillionaires. And, of course, Barry Goldwater, who was reelected in Arizona. The problem was, come January 1959, Nelson Rockefeller had to govern New York. Now, remember, 1959... we're 50 years closer to the New Deal. It's the cradle of the New Deal. The Democratic Party in New York is really beholden to Mrs. Roosevelt and Herbert Lehman, not Carmine DiSapio and Tammany Hall. So for Nelson Rockefeller to succeed in New York in that era, almost guaranteed in the long run, west of the Hudson, he would come to be seen as a very suspect figure indeed. And that's pretty much what happened.
Well, now,
the irony is, though, fiscal responsibility was defined differently in those days.
Why did he turn down Nixon's offer to be his vice president?
Well,
no one would do that now.
Now, some would say arrogance. He could not see himself. He said later on, I've known every vice president since Henry Wallace, and they were all miserable. And he knew himself. You know, he'd been offered a race for the Senate. He said, all they do there is talk. Nelson Rockefeller, first of all, was an executive by nature, by temperament, and secondly, he was a Rockefeller, okay? I mean, you combine those, plus the fact is there was no love lost between he and Richard Nixon. Ideologically, there's a wonderful scene, two scenes about 1960. Bob Novak, the late, great Bob Novak, told me about off-the-record interviews he had with Nelson Rockefeller and Barry Goldwater and the advice that each of them gave to Richard Nixon. And you can write it yourself, you know. Goldwater said, whatever you do, don't go chasing, you know, northern black folks. And Rockefeller said, whatever you do, don't go chasing southern segregation.
When we come back, we're also going to talk about the key lesson for everyone involved in 2016. Richard Norton Smith says in his brand new book, On His Own Terms, Rockefeller never grasped the nominating process. We'll talk about what that means when we return to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Minutes after the hour, America, it's Hugh Hewitt. Welcome. Aloha. It's my first day of broadcasting from Hawaii from the AM 690 The Answer. If you have a call or a comment for Richard Norton Smith, my guest and the author of On His Own Terms, A Life of Nelson Rockefeller, presidential historian extraordinaire, frequent guest on C-SPAN and everywhere on McNeil Lair, and perhaps the guy you know best as the collocator with me of the President's Day show every single year. You can call 1-800-520-1234 or tweet to me at Hugh Hewitt, as did, and I'll just go to it, Mark from Twitter, Richard, ask about Rockefeller giving the middle finger to someone in a widely circulated photo. This is the 1976 campaign, and yeah. I think SUNY, right, SUNY?
Yeah, it was in Binghamton, New York. And the irony, of course, was the protesting students were themselves students at SUNY Binghamton. Well, Nelson Rockefeller's arguably greatest accomplishment as governor of New York was SUNY, which was a university in name only when he became governor, and he really poured resources into it. So anyway, he was there with Bob Dole. They were campaigning in upstate New York, and there were student protesters who, you know, after Attica, which was in 1971, Rockefeller never really fully escaped the consequences of that. And particularly, you know, he'd always been a real favorite on college campuses. And needless to say, that was a thing of the past. So anyway, they were interrupting, and he was trying to speak and introduce Dole and so on and so on. He said afterward he simply was returning the one-fingered salute that they gave him. But in any event, America was shocked to see on the front page the next day the Vice President of the United States engaging in such a gesture.
But for a while, he would autograph that picture.
Someone went into him a few days later, and they found him at his desk autographing the picture and said, Mr. Vice President, you can't do that. You're the Vice President of the United States. And this is part of what made Rocky delightful. You know, he said, why not? He said, I got more good mail about that than anything since the 64 convention. The wonderful sort of asterisk to this is Malcolm Wilson, an underrated, truly conservative lieutenant governor for 15 years. He said he'd been number two longer than Avis. And he had a wonderful dry sense of humor. When this happened, Malcolm, who was very, very close to the Catholic hierarchy in New York, he said he was sure that Nelson mistook his fingers, and he intended to give them a thumbs-up side.
Now, I would love to know if in the world of political memorabilia, Frank Luntz has this extraordinary collection in his home in Los Angeles, if there's a signed Nelson Rockefeller giving the bird out there somewhere. I'll bet it doesn't come on the market very often.
Well, that would
often
be like, you know, the stamp with the upside-down airplane.
Exactly, exactly. Now, let me go back to the observation you made on page 427. He had a fundamental misunderstanding of the presidential nominating process, and I always bring this up to people who talk about drafts there are filing deadlines. You know, Romney can't sit on the sidelines. If he's going to run again, he's got to run because you've got to get delegates. And I think that's why On His Own Terms is such a valuable primer for a young person. The world of presidential nominations is about delegate getting.
Yeah. And you know, it's funny. Classic example. Some of it was a quasi-aristocratic, old-fashioned notion that, you know, the office is, well, you know, Ronald Reagan used to say, you know, the man doesn't seek the office seeks the man, until Stu Spencer said he was full of you-know-what. People who really know politics know better. Part of it was Rockefeller never really understood, and I think here in New York was a factor. Remember what he, you know, remember the electorate that he was playing to in New York. And the fact is he had great success. You know, he got 40% of the African-American vote in New York. He got huge percentages of the Jewish vote, people who were part of the old New Deal coalition. The only Republican they voted for was, right, in some cases, was Nelson Rockefeller. The problem is, over time, I think that dulled his sensibility about what it took to go to Wyoming or Nebraska or Indiana or Louisiana and appeal to a very different kind of Republican. And so he always ran a November campaign. He always ran campaigns that were geared toward the general electorate, toward independent and Democratic voters. The classic example is 1968, after Bobby Kennedy was killed. There was a void, and Nelson Rockefeller, it's widely agreed, moved very skillfully to fill it. He picked up all sorts of endorsements from the Kennedy supporters, big crowds of African-Americans, Hispanics. In other words, much of the Kennedy constituency was prepared to cross the street and support Rockefeller. The problem with that is it wasn't going to get him a single delegate.
By contrast with his 1964 Oregon state primary campaign, the model retelling of which, you have a little bit of art in this book, you have a lot of art in this book, but one small masterpiece like the Picasso etching he gave to Buffy Chandler.
Is
Bob Price going to Oregon with John Deardorff, right? Or is it Doug Bailey? I think it's Deardorff.
Deardorff.
And basically winning Oregon with a two-man show and an unlimited budget and envelopes of cash.
Well, part of this book, naturally, is a how-to. It's a life. It's a story of a life. But that life interacts over and over again with the process. And the great challenge, of course, it's a lot easier to make a life colorful than a process. But in this case, you know, you're dealing with wonderful, colorful characters and a wealth of newly available information. And the fact is the Oregon primary was, along with Rockefeller's reelection in 66, that's the great campaign. That's the campaign that still affects how we elect people because of its use of television, its use of experts, its use of direct mail, computers, targeting. You know, long before the Obama and Romney people were, you know, targeting to neighborhoods, the fact is, you know, 50 years ago, Rockefeller was pioneering at this.
You know, I'm going to talk to you about this next hour. It's also a primer on staff, whether it's the irascible Emmett Hughes or Ronan or all that. Yeah. We'll talk about that next hour. But anyone who's ever staffed an office, I think of all these 14 senators coming to Washington, D.C., they need to read this because of what the great benefits and downsides of staff mean. Who's
and
his
also,
best?
Hopefully sometime we can talk about presidents.
Oh, we will. I want to go back to Robert Price, though. Rocky grabs him after he wins Oregon. I love you. Will you go to California? He turns him down because of John Lindsay.
Because of John Lindsay. One thing, if you know nothing else, John Lindsay and Nelson Rockefeller were put on this planet to piss each other off.
Oh, and you know what I love about this book? Biographies rarely include other biographies, but there's enough. I now know enough about John Lindsay. I liked him. I used to like him. Now I don't like him at all. I mean, you demolished him. You wrote him over in this book.
He is a disappointing figure. Yeah,
that's mild. When you finish on his own terms.
Nelson said if he wasn't so tall and good looking, he'd be pushing a mop somewhere.
There's someone who reads on his own terms will agree with that. Richard Norton Smith is my guest. 1-800-520-1234. Connection to the Hugh Hewitt Show. I'll be back with him, and we're talking presidents, including Gerald Ford and Richard Nixon, and of course Ronald Reagan. We come back to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Thirty-four minutes after the hour, America, it's Hugh Hewitt, aloha, broadcasting this week from Hawaii at the AM 690, The Answer. And my guest today is Richard Norton Smith, and we are covering the waterfront, which has a number of peers into it because of his new book, On His Own Terms, A Life of Nelson Rockefeller. There's so many places I can get on and off the conversation, but I want to get off for a moment at the end of the book where you talk about how Rockefeller's death in essence, unleashed the new journalism on the personal lives of politicians. I had never thought about that, but you're right. Prior to that, only the most diffident of touches were applied to people's private lives. But after that, Gary Hart, everything else became fair game.
You know, I think so. I think that's the... I'll never forget, I had a conversation with the late, great Hal Bruno, who was really the class of his field, in my opinion, a great journalist. He was on the bus. He was on the Kennedy bus tour of Wisconsin in 1960. And everyone was aware of the senator's extramarital interests. And these were working reporters who really liked JFK. They came up with their own slogan for the campaign, which was, "Let's shack with Jack."
Exactly.
But nobody in a million years would have thought about writing that or talking about that. And one reason, call me naive, I finally came to realize after talking to a number of journalists over the years, guess what? For journalists, a presidential campaign was every bit as much a temporary vacation from their marital vows.
As you write in the book.
As a candidate. So it was, they had a vested interest in maintaining silence.
Oh, that glimpse, though, and people can read the last two chapters you can go to the bookstore. I don't recommend it for the benefit of the author, but on his own terms, the last chapter, if you want to know about the way Rocky went out. And the media screw up, and it taught transparency and waiting, Richard. As you said, this is a tutorial.
The sad thing was, there are a number of sad things. First of all, the important, there's one significant question that we need answered about that night, and it's very simple. Could anything have been done differently? Leave aside the cover-up that unraveled. Leave aside all the embarrassing jokes. But was there anything that medically could have been done? And I'm convinced the answer to that is no. One thing that people did not know, and that the book reveals for the first time, the fact is he was dying. He knew he was dying. A couple nights before he died, said as much.
Oh, it's conversation with Happy as he leaves the dinner that night.
Yeah, no, it's extraordinary. So that said, 40 years later, that's the difference between journalism and history. Historians rely on journalists enormously. I certainly did for famously the first draft of history. But historians have the advantage that journalists don't have, and that is the perspective that comes with, in this case, 40 years of intervening events. And the real significance of that night, in my opinion, is that it did give rise to a whole different school of journalism. That night, journalists began redefining what was personal and private and what the public had, quote, a right to know. I think it's a murky distinction. I think you could raise a good argument on either side as to whether it's been healthy or not for our political process. But, there it is. You're not going to roll the clock back.
There is also, there is a very short bit in there on the 124 card, which tells young journalists there is no substitute for going to the precinct and talking to people.
Well, that's it. Great reporters, in this case, John Goldman of the L.A. Times, he heard this news that Nelson Rockefeller... Remember, the original story was he had been stricken in his office at Rockefeller Center working on an art book and so forth and so on. Okay, he thought, that sounds odd. He called a friend in the police department who whetted his curiosity. So he headed... What did he do? He headed to the precinct house, and he got this document, which by law at that point was mandated in situations like this, and it became very clear that Nelson Rockefeller did not die at Rockefeller Center, but at his townhouse on 54th Street. And with that, the hastily improvised cover-up, which, by the way, was not something the family wanted. It was something that Hugh Morrow, who was Rockefeller's communications director, thinking that he would spare the family embarrassment, came up with on his own. And of course, it turned out
It failed. And boy, did it fail spectacularly.
And it diminished him. It diminished Rockefeller. It made him a joke for a while.
On his own terms, does not spare any of those details. A Life of Nelson Rockefeller is linked at HughHewitt.com. And more on present-day lessons for Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, John Kasich, Scott Walker, all of them, when we return to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Forty-four minutes after the hour, America, it's Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show. I have got an extraordinary guest with me, Richard Norton Smith, presidential historian, wonderful and celebrated lecturer on all things of American politics. You see him on C-SPAN, PBS all the time. You hear him on the show whenever I can grab him. His brand new bestseller book is On His Own Terms, A Life of Nelson Rockefeller. And I've said already a few times in the course of this show, and I'm going to say it again right now, it is a primer for anyone who cares about American politics. And I repair Richard to the 1964 campaign again. Yeah. Goldwater and Rockefeller. Lodge wins New Hampshire. Rockefeller comes back in Oregon. And it all comes down to California. And the great legendary political pitchman Stuart Stevens is in charge. And he, by the way, I think his wheel spinners party is underway this week, as a matter of fact. He is in charge along with Bill Roberts. And they end up losing to Barry Goldwater 51.3 to 48.7 or something like that.
And you know one reason why it was so close? Amazing. Stu told me. He said, I've never seen it in any election before, and I've never seen it since. God's honest truth. They had a small, they thought, for 50 people, breakfast for African-Americans, people with a particular connection to Spelman College or the United Negro College Fund, Rockefeller family charities, if you will, and like 300 people showed up. Well, it spiraled out of that. 55,000 voters, almost all in L.A. County and almost all of them black, changed their registration.
Right.
From Democrat to Republican so they could vote for Nelson Rockefeller.
But the warning, and I said Stuart Stevens, who is Romney's consultant, I meant Stuart Spencer.
Yes,
the warning Spencer has is of second-guessing from out-of-staters over going soft at the end. They canceled the movie, The Extremist.
Yes.
It's such a great lesson for political operatives.
And let's not forget, you know, 3 days before the primary, Nelson Rockefeller Jr. was born. And the thing that I discovered that I find hard to believe, but I've been assured by people at the highest levels of the campaign, it was decided that if necessary, they would induce labor.
You see, that makes no sense. The happy Rockefeller divorce took Nelson Rockefeller, as Richard Norton Smith says, from a 17-point favorite in the Lou Harris polls in 1963 to a 5-point deficit.
Well, it was a different culture. And I, you know, who knows today what the result would be. But the fact is, in fact, you know, Nelson and his first wife, Todd, had really been living a marriage in name only for many years. And there had been a number of women along the way. And then he met Happy. And for whatever reason, and I talked to her about it, she said he was the one who pursued her.
How much time did you spend with Happy Rockefeller? How much time?
Wise woman.
How much time did you spend with her? Because it's amazing detail.
Yeah, well, I spent a day with her. She gave me a tour. I'll tell you a quick, wonderful story about the impact of Nelson's mother, Abby, on Nelson. Because I'd been told that Nelson kept his mother's ashes in the house.
Took a pocketful, right?
At Kaikit. Yeah. And sure enough, Happy confirmed. I said, but how could that be? There was a funeral, and they buried Abby's ashes. And she said, oh, Nelson just reached in and grabbed a handful.
That's amazing.
Now, that tells you something about his sense of entitlement.
Yes.
You know? But also about his almost childlike impulsiveness. You know,
now, I've never been to Kikit. I don't even know where it is. And is it open to the public?
Yes, it is. In fact, yeah. By all means, it's 30 miles north of Times Square. You go up along the Hudson. It was 4,000 acres of Westchester County in Nelson's day. You can imagine. And Kikit is Dutch for lookout. It's the tallest point overlooking the river, and that's where John D. Rockefeller Sr. Had a manor house constructed for him by his son, John D. Rockefeller Jr., and then the third generation, represented by Nelson, came into the inheritance.
It's amazing, and he decorated with all these amazing art treasures. You tell a story towards the end of the book where he sells off a Henry Moore sculpture, and he tells his friend, you have to be able to turn things off.
And yeah, you know, toward the end of his life, a week before he dies, and this friend said he was particularly impressed by how Nelson seemed to be able to walk away from, you know, his life in politics. And Rockefeller said something rather profound. He said, look, in this business, you've got to know when you're a has-been.
Yeah,
and I'm a has-been.
Wow. There's very little of that self-recognition in many places anymore.
I think we can all agree on that.
Yeah. So anyway, Happy Rockefeller, do you have any idea what the family thinks about this book? Because you mentioned, interestingly enough, David Horowitz of Peter Collier's book, which was sort of a glimpse into the archives, which scandalized Rocky. How does the family think about what is obviously...
I don't know. To be honest with you, and I'm not being evasive. For one thing, I don't think there is such a thing today as the family. You know, I mean, 30, 40 years ago, first of all, there were a lot fewer Rockefellers. And the culture, you know, the brothers' culture, Nelson and David,
Lawrence,
who was the only surviving brother, now 99, and John and Winthrop. I mean, that was a different, in many ways, a more cohesive. They had for one thing, they were all Republicans. Today, I suspect if you sat down at a reunion of the Rockefeller family, you'd probably find at least as many Democrats as Republicans.
Among the cousins. Among the
cousins and their
children of the cousins.
That's right, yeah.
And did the foundation keep its course?
Well, that was an interesting... Yeah, that's part of what Nelson got into trouble over when he came back from Washington, you know, profoundly disappointed in his vice presidency. He thought, rather naively, as it turned out, that he would simply step back into his old shoes, you know, sort of his head of the family, and he would, among other things, be responsible for steering the Rockefeller Foundation or the Rockefeller Brothers Fund or other, you know, charities associated with the family. And he discovered to his chagrin that there was a whole new generation called the cousins who were eager to take their own place and who disagreed with him about Vietnam and Attica, and who frankly resented the financial disclosure and all the other publicity that they had to go through for the first time because of his vice presidential hearings.
Oh, 4 months of vice presidential agony. Maybe also, as was his death, a launch of investigatory journalism. The Rockefeller hearings in 1974, a prelude to the Borking of Robert Bork and many other unfortunate confirmation fiascos. Don't go anywhere. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. 55 minutes after the hour, America, it's Hugh Hewitt reminding everyone, Richard Norton Smith is my guest for another hour, talking about his book, On His Own Terms, A Life of Nelson Rockefeller, and all of its applicability to today. And I am reminded, over at HughHewitt.com, there is the Red Kettle campaign, your opportunity to be generous in ways large and small for the lost and the least this time of year. Just go to HughHewitt.com and click on the Red Kettle. You can also click on the link to purchase Richard's book, On His Own Terms, and you'll be grateful for it. But Richard, during the break, I was looking at my Twitter feed. 20 minutes ago, Secretary of State Kerry tweeted out, standing in solidarity with our ally Australia today, our hearts are with the victims and their families, hashtag Sydney, hashtag U.S. with AUS. And that's wonderful and heartfelt, and I talked to a couple of Australians today about that, in Hawaii, in fact. But I was reminded in your book, one of the few times Nelson Rockefeller became choked up, you say, is when he was delivering a speech on the American-Australian special relationship. And I wondered at that point, was that because they tried so hard to find Michael when he was lost in New Guinea?
No, that's a great point. And of course, and it was in Sydney. He was on a bicycle. Here's an indication of just how politically spent, almost irrelevant he had become. In the spring of 1976, when Ronald Reagan and Gerald Ford were duking it out in one of the classic personal, philosophical confrontations, certainly in modern Republican history, Nelson Rockefeller was on a bicentennial tour to Iran and Tahiti and Australia, which tells you volumes about his political worth at that point. Even to, you know, but of course, by that time he'd been dumped, remember, you know, as vice president. He was a good soldier. He produced the delegates that put Ford over the top.
From New York and Connecticut and Jersey.
And Pennsylvania, yeah. But you're right. Australia did have a special place in his heart. And it may very well, you know, I had not thought about that, but it makes absolute sense. People who were there said it was by far the most effective and emotional speech that he gave on this entire trip.
You also, you mentioned in the book that there are reports that Todd Rockefeller, his first wife, hired the Australian private detective agency of the era to try. Is there controversy about Michael? There's a new book about him.
Yeah, there is. And I want to be very careful because there are books that are really kind of thoughtful, and this one is one. It's called, I believe it's called Savage Harvest.
Yes.
And based upon very extensive original research, you know, he went there, he talked to people. There have been other, shall we say, tabloid.
Yeah. Oh, it's a heart. People just should read your section on this because it's heartbreaking, actually. Nelson Rockefeller flies around the clock to oversee the search for his lost son, who's in the jungles, lost on a river. It's breaking your heart. I'll be back one more hour ahead with Richard Norton Smith. Indeed, stand with AUS today. Hashtag US with AUS. I'll be right back on the New York Show.